We're at Angel Fire in New Mexico, and Stanton T. Friedman's with us, and everybody knows you, Stan. You've been around for a long time, and now...
That's a penalty for being old.
Yeah. Well,
and bold, and loud.
I can understand that, being the same.
I don't know which of us is older, to tell you the truth.
You just slightly.
Oh, okay.
Just slightly. You would tell me, first of all, before we do anything, tell me a little bit about this Magic Man movie thing that Bruce Zabel was talking to me about.
Bryce Zabel, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I've known Bryce for about 15 years, and actually he wrote a favorable review on the back cover of the book Top Secret Magic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about the Majestic 12 documents.
Right.
And especially in the second edition, I make a point of trying to deal with all the objections to these documents that have been put forth by the noisy negativists of one kind or another. And I think I have satisfactorily provided a rebuttal for all of these objections. And yet there are still people in ufology who say, well, everybody knows those documents are fraudulent. And it's aggravating because they don't give you facts and data. I've been at this a long time. I've been to 20 archives. Anyway, Bryce has been well aware. You know, he did the series... Dark Skies,
mm-hmm.
which really is a similar sort of thing to the Majestic 12 business. So he also knows Don Schmidt and how Don has had his ups and downs in Roswell investigation, and that Don's and my paths have crossed from time to time. Don didn't really start into Roswell until he asked me a question at a lecture I gave in Illinois at a college. He said, is there really anything more to be done with Roswell? This is 20 years ago. And I said, Don, there's plenty to do, but I can't afford to do it. I've been spending tons of money on trying to locate people and all the rest. I live back very far east. yeah, there's a lot to be done. There are more witnesses to be found, more documents to be found. So he pursued his path of investigating, which he's done a lot of. He's changed partners, so have I, in a sense. And Bryce saw the possibilities here of something, put it succinctly, would be sort of like all the president's men and JFK combined.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, there's dramatic impact here. There's conflict. There's how things have progressed, positive and negative. We both had problems with some witnesses who turned out to be fraudulent. You know, and how do you handle this? We think, considering that we've been at this, you know, it's more than 20 years. I've been investigating Roswell for 32 years, that it might bring the story home to the public in a way that only movies can. You know, I've got my name on 5 books now, and Don has written several books. But in today's world, a movie can have far more impact than a book. I mean, I hate to admit that. So I'm hoping that they're working on a screenplay now. And, you know, the funny question is, so who's going to play you, Stan? And I don't know who's going to play me in the movie. In other words, this will be a feature film.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a documentary.
Right.
It's a movie that has a story to tell.
You mentioned All the President's Men as something similar to that,
that
movie.
Yeah, the efforts that those guys went through, Woodward and Bernstein. And,
right.
You know, I've been saying for years, people say, what would it take to break this story loose? I've said it would take a Woodward and Bernstein with some backing from somebody like the Washington Post. It wasn't just those two guys after all. There was a lot of money spent, you know, following the money, doing all those other things that need to be done. And I think you could do it in 6 months if you really made the effort. So I'm excited at the prospect, partly because I respect Bryce and Don Most, they're both very interested in the subject. People remember Don Most from Happy Days, but he's also been involved in other motion pictures
yes,
and production and so forth. So, and Bryce is a wheel in the industry in Hollywood, if you will, president of one of the important groups and stuff.
Yeah, despite me mispronouncing his first name, I do know him and met him recently. And he's quite a go-getter.
He is a go-getter. And so I'm excited about I've had other dealings with Hollywood. Every so often somebody, we want to make a show, you want to be involved. Yeah, I'm interested. And they never seem to work out. And, even my own documentary, UFOs Are Real, which was done way back in, 79. It's hard to imagine. My dealings with Hollywood were not not the kind that I really appreciated, because I'm concerned with facts, with data, with truth. That's what a scientist is all mm-hmm. about. And these guys, that didn't seem to be their major concern.
Yeah.
But Bryce,
that's an understatement.
Yeah, I'm being kind. Be kind to dumb Hollywoodians. I just made up a new word. So I'm really hopeful that this will turn into something good and big. And, you know, I must admit, in making UFOs Are Real, and I travel all over the country, I found movie making one of the most frustrating things I've ever done. Because you spend hours, days to get, you know, 3 minutes worth of film.
Mm-hmm.
And you slog along day after day, and I'm too impatient for that. I want to, if I'm going to go to an archive, I want to dig into things, you know, get yeah. hours worth of work, not 2 minutes worth of work.
Yeah, this project, even though it's now well underway, will probably be 18 months or so before it's finished.
Oh, at least, yeah. And I just hope I'm around when it's finished, that's all. And my great-grandson can see his great-grandpa portrayed yeah. in the film.
Uh-huh. Now, you mentioned a couple of things that I wanted to follow up here a little bit about. Don Smith, you're the one that got him interested, huh?
Well, to dig into Roswell, yes.
Yes.
The fund for UFO research had been sort of off to the side. Not the fund, I'm sorry, the QFOS, Dr. Hynek's organization, and Don worked closely with Dr. Hynek. And they were very, how shall I put this, conservative about crash saucers. Center for UFO Studies, we're mm-hmm. talking about. And, you know, I knew Alan. He was the same age as my father. He didn't like being reminded of that. But I could never get him to dig into this question of interstellar travel. For some reason, and it's part of what I'm going to say here, astronomers are stuck at the Pony Express stage of development of human transport. You know, if you were to say, what's a fast means for spreading information? If you told me Pony Express, I'd say, I'll take the Internet, you know, instantaneous yeah. kind of thing. These guys haven't gotten beyond the notion of chemical rockets, for God's sakes. And Alan had the same problem. So Don asked me only because he knew that I had been digging into it for a long time and would have some idea of what the scope of the work. I won't say I inspired him. That's probably the wrong way to put it. But I gave him a straight answer, and I said I'd help if I could, and I have. And we've shared views about witnesses and so forth. We also have spent a lot of time in Roswell, he more than I would say. You mentioned
a little earlier that both of you have been led down the primrose path occasionally. I have, too. We all have.
Really?
Yeah. Why do you think these guys do this sort of thing?
You know, I don't know. Frank Kaufman was his bête noir. And the funny thing is, right from the beginning with Frank, I was suspicious because he said and did things that didn't make any sense to me. And I was pleased, at least before he died, that when I asked him, now, Frank, remember, had this great story. He was a member of a group of nine at Roswell, and they could do anything. They knew everybody. They had everything. He knew all about Roswell. And he was over at White Sands when they spotted on radar this object that exploded on the screen, and he called back, and somebody had seen something come down. He rushed back over the mountains to Roswell, woke up Colonel Blanchard and Jesse Marcel, and they drove out across the rough country and spotted this craft on the ground. And, you know, by the end of the day, the end of that morning, they had brought out a flatbed truck from Roswell and put this thing on it and brought it back to the base, and, you know, just like that. And to me, that made absolutely no sense whatsoever. In the first place, you can't, the people who owned the land said the only way you could get out in that area was with a horse. There were no roads mm-hmm. and stuff. And secondly, Colonel Blanchard was head of the only atomic bombing group in the world. he would never have left the base without some better idea of what was going on out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it was one of his B-29s, which just happened to have a nuclear weapon on board, yeah, he'd have gone out right. But other than something like that, he never would have. Jesse Marcel, I was the first to talk to Jesse way back in 1978.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that. Go ahead.
Well, I just said he would never have reacted the way he did days later if he had already been out there, already seen bodies and wreckage and all this kind of stuff. And it's standard practice when an airplane goes down that you want to see things in situ, that is, as they are, so that you can discover, you know, was in the case of an airplane, was the landing gear cracked, were the flaps up or down? And you can't just go gathering stuff up and shove it on a truck and get it out of there. There was no danger of tourists coming along. This was out in the middle of nowhere. You know, that was not a problem. So I was pleased when Frank finally, just before he died, I was at his home with several other people and asked him, did he take Blanchard out? No. Did he take Jesse Marcel out? No. So I was sort of indicated, but I couldn't convince Don's former associate, Kevin Randall. To him, Frank Kaufman was the answer to all the problems. He's got a whole book in which Frank's name comes up all the time, mm-hmm. as knowing everything. And to me, I understood Frank. He was from New York, which helped explain a few things. Yeah. I'm from New Jersey. That was part of the problem. Also, there was a whole business with Bill Moore and me and Don and Kevin Randall, conflict and human interactions, if you will. And people wanted to blame me for what Bill was doing, and Kevin turned on Don, had apparently said that he had some degrees he didn't have, and Kevin defended Don without doing any checking. What I did was the next day after I heard that, I called the post office where supposedly Don worked, and he answered the phone. He wasn't just walking by.
Mm-hmm.
So he had never told me he had those degrees, so I didn't feel, you know, that he had lied to me. Anyway, there is conflict, and there are joys, too. Frankly, when I heard about the MJ-12 documents, Bill Moore called me up and read me the list of the names of people, and he saved the best one for last, Donald Menzel, Harvard debunker of UFOs. Boy, that's all we need with somebody, you know, was that. And I didn't like Menzel. I'd had one run-in with him. At Harvard, I was speaking to a retired an engineering alumni group,
mm-hmm.
and I called him earlier in the day because I didn't know whether this was a campus-wide thing or just for this group. I often give presentations to members of a certain group, American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, that sort of thing. So I called, and Dr. Menzel, yes, my name is Stanton Friedman, and, oh, I know all about you, he says. I said, oh, you saw my congressional testimony next to yours? No, I've seen letters and memos. You can't be a scientist and believe in flying saucers. And I laughed. What else am I going to do?
Yeah.
He got mad, started ranting. And I said, look, Dr. Menzel, I didn't call to argue with you. I called out of courtesy. I'm going to be speaking on your campus and didn't know whether you knew about it. So I wanted to invite you personally to be there. Of course I won't go. And I told that story that night at the lecture, incidentally, and Alan Hynek told me he never could have told the story. Anyway, so here his name is on this list. And I'm thinking, boy, that's all we need. Well, I had a couple of leads that maybe moved me in the right direction. And some of the Vannevar Bush papers. Vannevar Bush was the top dog scientist in the country, head of the Office of Scientific Research and Development, which covered the atom bomb and a proximity fuse and 80 other devices for winning a war. And there was a letter in his papers from Menzel's attorney thanking Bush for his testimony on Donald's behalf at a loyalty hearing. Loyalty hearing? That raised a lot of questions. There's a big legal firm in Boston. This was not a little podunk outfit mm-hmm. that wrote the letter. And Bush didn't have to defend anybody. He was above all that sort of stuff. And then I got a grant from the Fund for UFO Research that would cover the cost of going to Harvard. I had to get permission from three different people to look at his papers. I had already seen his UFO correspondence at the American Philosophical Society Library in Philadelphia. Nothing exciting there, except the communication between him and Ed Condon. They obviously knew each other and stuff. So I'm going there with an open mind and not really having any idea of finding anything very useful. And at the Harvard archives, after getting permission from three different people to look at this stuff, I don't see anything. So just because I'm a curious guy, there was a file labeled John F. Kennedy. That seems strange. And so I looked at that file and was totally shocked because there's correspondence between him and Kennedy. Now, the connection was straightforward. Kennedy was on the board of overseers at Harvard, and his area of interest, and every member picked an area and got to know it better, was astronomy. And so Menzel was his guide, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, and I got this from his wife, too, that Menzel, like JFK, greatly respected him, was impressed. He even wrote his own reports, and there were other guys who had asked Menzel to write the report for them, you know. But here we find a statement, Menzel to Kennedy, saying, there is an area where I may be able to be of considerable utility. That's with regard to the National Security Agency. I have had a longer continuous association with this organization, more than 30 years at that time, of anybody in the country. When we are properly cleared to each other, I can tell you more. You know, those are rather exciting words. And then when I look at his unpublished autobiography, there's Menzel saying he was very active in cryptography. He was did classified work for the FBI, for the CIA, for 30 different companies. He led a double life. Nobody on the outside knew that.
Mm-hmm.
As far as they knew, he was a debunker. And the thing that really caught me is you don't need a high-level security clearance to teach astronomy at Harvard. You know, all the other 11 out of the 12, I knew from the jobs they'd held that they had to have high-level security mm-hmm. clearances. Three were directors of Central Intelligence, you know, stuff like that. So these findings on Menzel, and then talking to his wife, talking to people who knew him at the office, I found one guy who was very close to him who knew that he did a lot of work for the government. That's all, you know. He didn't know anything about MJ-12 or anything like that. And then, so I kept digging, and as a matter of fact, somebody, a MUFON person in Minneapolis, mentioned that they had had a big 50th anniversary of the organization thing, and he got to talk to somebody there who mentioned that he knew Menzel, and that Menzel had left in a hurry one time under sort of strange circumstances. So I talked to the guy. And yes, he was younger at the time than Menzel was. And Menzel suddenly had to leave. He did consulting work. As a matter of fact, I found papers in Menzel's file. He was getting like $18,000 a year as a consultant. This is back in the 40s.
And that good
was
money.
A very good money. I'll tell you. And so I asked this guy, and he said, yeah, he remembered Menzel, and he was a younger man than the one I was talking to. And I said, there was something about, at one point he left in a hurry. He said, yeah, one summer, he worked there summers usually, mm-hmm. you know, as many professors do. And he suddenly had to leave. And he had the impression, the guy I was talking to, that it was very classified and that Menzel did, and it was important. And Menzel wouldn't tell him what it was, just that he had to be gone. And so I asked very carefully, biting my tongue the whole time, what year was that? And there was a pause, and said, well, let me see now. Yeah, 1947, I think. I didn't say, was it 47?
Yeah, right.
Which would just provide me with an echo, which would mean nothing. So anyway, to make a long story short, the joy of finding out that Menzel belonged to that team, much as I didn't like him, I developed an appreciation for him. And I had so much reaction. How can a guy lead a double life? I said, every spy leads a double life. There were three guys in England, Burgess, McLean, and whoever the third guy was, he was the most famous of them, who were spies for Russia working for MI5. Now, that's leading a double life because you've really got to be careful.
Certainly a double agent, right.
You know, and so it happens all the time. anyway, that was a high point. There were low points. You tracked down people. I found a guy, an archaeologist, who mentioned that one of the stories that I was very interested in was the crash over in the plains of San Augustine.
Mm-hmm.
And found a guy named, his name was Drake, actually, not Frank Drake. And he mentioned that there was this guy that he knew who had come to a conference in Mexico and had worked at Los Alamos and had stopped by the plains of San Augustine. He knew something from working at Los Alamos that there had been a crash in the plains of San Augustine. And I got his name, and he lived in Ottawa, and it was an unusual enough name, so I was able to track it down, a number, called, talked to his wife, and he's off on a dig in British Columbia, and he'll be back in a month. Call back then. Okay, great. I established this guy was a professional. He was a PhD, legitimate researcher and all that. And I called back a month later, and he had just died of a heart attack.
Wow.
And, you know, what do you ask a widow? It just happened. And so a year later, I called. She remembered me because her sister had just died. So mm-hmm. That's twice I hit. So that was great disappointment, you know. Why didn't I call 5 days sooner or stuff like that? One of the frustrations. I was able to establish that he had been at Los Alamos. And Los Alamos has an enormous amount of information. When I visited there, I had professional dealings as a nuclear physicist on the nuclear rocket program. They were working on nuclear rockets. We at Westinghouse were. So I was able to look in their library, and they had a lot of stuff on UFOs. Obviously, there was great interest there. As a matter of fact, the first privately published version of Project Blue Book, Special Report 14, came from a scientist who had worked at Los Alamos. And that really got me rolling on UFOs. So to get back to Magic Men, as I've talked to Bryce and Don Schmidt has talked to them, we've come up with a lot of these little events that happened, these significant events that, in retrospect, have dramatic impact. And so I'm optimistic that with his skills and imagination and knowledge of the field, a lot of people who want to do a UFO movie because they think people would be interested, but don't know a damn thing.
Right.
And so that's what's different here, is that we have people who...
So you're really hopeful that this movie, if it gets made, and probably will, and you know the people involved, so it'll probably turn out pretty well, it may open some doors, get some people interested.
Yeah, because I found that people never want to be leading the pack and coming out from behind the veil of secrecy. I worked under security for 14 years. I understand that. And, you know, I get people are so ignorant about security. I've had one guy say, well, all those members of MJ-12 would have told their spouses. No, you don't tell your wife. I never told my wife anything classified.
Mm-hmm.
You can't control what your wife says to anybody.
Right.
If the enemy thinks he can get information from spouses, the heck with you. You know, pillow talk, that's the way to find out what's going on. I've had people say, the SETI people really aggravate me. Silly effort to investigate. That's
you're talking SETI. About that here, I think.
Yeah, that's one of the major points that I will make. Is here we got these guys saying, the government can't keep secrets. And Seth Shostak, now I've met Seth, he's heard me talk, I've heard him talk. Big shot in the SETI field. I mean, this is a government that, look how they fouled up at Katrina and FEMA and stuff. It's the same government that runs a post office, for God's sakes. Now, why didn't he say something like the NRO, the NSA, the CIA, mm-hmm. the DIA, all the intelligence agencies? How about Lockheed developing the stealth aircraft? 10 years, $10 billion in complete secrecy. I mean, I get a little irked at people who haven't done their homework. And part of my theme today, or tomorrow, actually, will be that they don't seem to realize that aside from research being conducted in academia, the publisher parish crowd, as I call them, there's an enormous amount of very good, advanced, applied research and development that goes on outside of academia. The national laboratories, Los Alamos, Sandia, Lawrence Livermore, three nuclear weapons labs, amongst them employ 20,000 people. Thousands of professionals each have an annual budget over $1 billion. This isn't six professors and 12 grad students, for goodness sakes. There are things like the General Electric Research Labs, the Bell Labs, the Lewis Research Labs. There's Hanford Works. There's Oak Ridge National Laboratory. There's a whole big community of people who much of their work is classified, but whose goal is to accomplish a particular objective on a particular program, whether it's building a nuclear airplane, testing a nuclear rocket engine. And it's the nuclear part that I've realized that these ancient academics and fossilized physicists have no idea that there's something beyond chemical rockets. You can't get here from there. The head of the Hayden Planetarium stupidly said, and I'd say that to his face, that, look, our fastest vehicle, the Voyager spacecraft, would take 70,000 years to get to the next star. What a stupid thing to say. It doesn't have a propulsion system on it. It's been coasting. Chemical rockets are not the be-all and end-all chemical reactions. That's like saying fossil fuel is it, for goodness sakes. And I will point out that many people don't seem to be aware. World War II, a big bomb, was a 10-ton blockbuster. B-29s would carry those, mm-hmm. and they make quite a mess below, you know. But that was World War II. Okay, come Hiroshima, suddenly the ante is up. That's the equivalent of 15,000 tons of TNT. That's a pretty good jump.
Yes, it is.
In a short period of time. Well, let's go beyond that. We figured out, I mean, look at the rapid pace. We didn't even discover there were neutrons until 1932. They've been here all the time, you understand, long before we knew them about them. We figured out that probably the process that produces the energy of the stars is nuclear fusion. That was in 1938, theoretical. We put it to use in 1952. We exploded our first H-bomb. Now, Hiroshima was 15,000 tons of TNT equivalent energy release. Mike, out in the Pacific, 10 million tons of TNT equivalent.
Yeah, it's just
one bomb.
Mind-boggling.
And the Russians exploded one that was 57 million tons. And the kicker about this is I worked on fusion propulsion systems. We did a study of it at Aerojet General Nucleonics back in the early 60s. And here's why. In the first place, every advanced civilization is going to know about fusion because that's what makes its star work. That's the big source of energy on the block, so to speak.
Yep.
In the second place, if you use the right stuff in the right way, and it just happens to be isotopes of hydrogen and helium, which is very convenient, these are the two most abundant substances in the universe. You may not find uranium everywhere, but you're going to find hydrogen and helium everywhere. Okay, if you use the right stuff in the right way and kick particles out the back end that have 10 million times as much energy per particle. 10 million
per
times
particle?
Per particle, as you can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. 10 million times. So why would anybody in his right mind, especially in the astronomical community, be stuck at the level of chemical reactions? Do they still think the sun is a mass of burning gas? Lord Kelvin thought that around the turn of the 20th century, 1902 or something like that. Not more than 30,000 years or 30 million years, doesn't matter. He thought it was chemical process. So what I'm getting at is, of course, this stuff was all done outside of academia. And these guys can't seem to understand that there's a new ballgame out there. You know, it's not the Pony Express. It's the Internet that we're looking at now for information transfer. Friedman's Law, I named stuff after myself, you know. Technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. And
it's
also
Friedman's Law. Okay.
Yeah. when we recognize how young we are on a cosmic scale. I mean, go back to the year 1900. We hadn't flown an airplane. We hadn't fired a rocket. Electronics were non-existent. DNA, fission, fusion, all this stuff didn't exist as far as we were concerned. Now, there are stars in our local neighborhood that are at least a billion years older than the sun. I mean, I got kind of a shock. I suppose I shouldn't have. I was speaking to a couple of college classes in Detroit, the University of Detroit, and I went through how much things have changed within my lifetime and pointed out that when I started working in industry, I was using a slide rule. I looked around the class, didn't see any reaction at all. So finally, I asked, I said, anybody here know what a slide rule is? Not one student in the class. That was less than 50 years earlier. So we've come a long way, and I'm sure these SETI cultists, as I call them, aren't using slide rules. They're using terabyte computers, for God's sakes. I wonder how much, if they appreciate how remarkable an inexpensive computer that's sitting on my desk, less than $1,000, what that would have been like 50 years ago. I mean, incredible. I think of some of the brilliant professors I had at Chicago, Singh Chandrasekhar, he did all kinds of calculations about radiation transfer in stars, basically with desk calculators. And if he had only had a computer, much more he might have accomplished, in just this short time frame. So my message to people is, A, that there's overwhelming evidence that some UFOs are alien spacecraft. B, that the reasons that it's not being taken seriously, besides the self-interest, I mean, let's face it, if aliens are visiting, who needs a radio telescope? Learn sign language, if you want to find out about life out there. They're not looking for intelligence. They're looking for radio signals. And I love the assumption, and we've been treated to discussions about this past 9 months. The assumption is that aliens are sending signals to us using technology appropriate for our equipment and for our times. Now, why would anybody make such a stupid assumption?
Yeah, lifetime, it's hard to find anybody who knows Morse code anymore.
Yeah, that doesn't happen every day, right. And the thing is that Stephen Hawking, a great physicist, says they're not coming here because if they had, they'd have sent us a signal first. What are you going to send? Hey, we're bringing 30 guys for dinner, and we don't like pork. They're Jewish out there, of course. But it's one of those utterly asinine notions that they would use technology appropriate to us when we've had such a short period of time. And look how, they're sending AM or FM, digital or analog. And what will the question be 50 years from now?
That's an interesting analogy, the AM or FM. I know younger people who just don't know how to find the AM band.
What's an AM? The morning show, isn't it? AM, morning?
And now FM's suffering the same thing as they go digital. So.
Yeah, and it's going to all be different in not very long.
Very shortly.
Yeah, and what people forget, there is a transition time. I got boxes of vinyl records at home.
Same here. Can't find a player.
I did find one. Still haven't used them. But, what we're both agreeing on is that technology has been changing very rapidly in a few years. But if you got tens of hundreds, thousands, millions of years, and, this is as bad as the Copernican, the attitude about Copernicus. Now, you got to admire the guy's guts. He had this crazy idea, which he wouldn't let be published. The book came out in the year he died, 1543, in which he had the gall to suggest, how stupid, that the Earth isn't the center of the universe. The belief was that the Earth's the center and the sun and the other planets revolve around the Earth. Very straightforward. Copernicus said, no, the sun is the center of the universe. The book was banned for 300 years, for God's sakes, because everybody knew that was nonsense. That was stupid. Well, okay. These guys don't seem to understand that we are now no longer next to the center of the universe. The sun isn't the center of the universe either. And that we're not the big shots these guys would like to think we are. We're latecomers. It's the time factor. I mean, you know, you realize we didn't discover that there were such things as neutrons until 1932. You'd think they didn't exist before we discovered them, you know. We've been made of neutrons all this time. There are many other things we didn't know until very, very recently. And most of them, that was discovered at a university, but most of the technological stuff was done outside the university environment. So we have, there ought to be a PhD thesis here. You know, the sociological complications of aliens visiting Earth. And the Brookings Institute report, I hadn't fully appreciated this, said one of the things that would happen if there was contact with extraterrestrials, one of the groups most affected would be scientists. Because their power, their omnipotence, their being the big shots would suddenly be down the tubes.
Their answers are wrong.
Yeah. And I begin to appreciate that now. I look at the desperation with which these guys are talking about radio signals.
Well, we see this, Stanton, and not only in our field, but almost everything. The human brain likes to think it's a great pioneer, is very egocentric, but for some reason they don't want to accept these new ideas. And I think part of it is that the establishment, they're making money, they're doing fine, they got a good reputation.
Status, yes. Well, there was a comment made by a German scientist, Max Planck. New ideas come to be accepted, not because their opponents come to believe in them, but because their opponents die and a new generation grows up that's accustomed to them. And that's what seems to happen, actually. They fight to their dying breath to defend the old way of looking at things.
We're talking with Stanton T. Friedman, and we are at Angel Fire, a great place in northern New Mexico. If you've never been here, you need to check it out. I'm Jerry Pippin, and Stanton, I had two things to ask you,
sure.
And we started, and I wanted to talk about the contemporary investigations of Stanton T. Friedman, but I'm going to go back now to the early years. Let's talk about that meeting with Jesse Marcel. You were at a television station, as I recall. Were you interested in this subject? Were you there doing a UFO show, or what were you doing?
Yeah, I got interested in flying saucers in 1958, read Ed Ruppelt's book, Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. He was head of Project Blue Book. And then the great discovery that set me off in a new direction was at the University of California, Berkeley Library. I mean, I'd read that one book, moved to California, had a good librarian, read 14 other books, some of which were utter trash, including one by Menzel, as a matter of fact. And there I am at the University of California, Berkeley. I was taking a course there, and so I could stop off at the library. And I discovered the report on unidentified flying objects. That was Ruppelt's book. That was there, too. But the one I found was Project Blue Book, Special Report 14. And here was data on 3,201 sightings. It was done for the Air Force. I didn't know who did it at that time. I found out later. They had quality evaluations, classification of all these sightings, statistical cross-comparison, 240 charts, tables, graphs, and maps. I was in data heaven. I like data. But the guy who put this together is Dr. Leon Davidson that I'd mentioned. Mm-hmm. He had included a copy of the press release that went out in October 1955. The government didn't release the report. They released a press release. The press release didn't say who did the work. They didn't say where the work was done, Battelle Memorial Institute, as I found out. They didn't give the title even. Surely some reporter, if they'd said 14, would have said, what happened to 1 through 13? We haven't heard anything about them. An honest answer, which wouldn't have been given, would have been that they were all classified. But the real kicker was a statement by the Secretary of the Air Force in this very widely distributed press release. On the basis of this report, we believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. That seems very straightforward. There's really nothing to this, just not enough data. But I had the report in front of me and was looking at the tables and the charts, and where'd that 3% come from? If you tabulate those 3,201 sightings, and they had categories like balloons and astronomical, you know, conventional stuff, psychological aberrations, crackpot cases, that was 1.5%, incidentally. Here were the unknowns. Were they 3%? No, they were 21.5%. That's not a misprint. You know, that's not a rounding off error. In addition, there was another category called insufficient information. If there wasn't enough data available about a sighting, it could not be listed as an unknown. And it's only the unknowns that we're interested in. There were 9.3% unknown, insufficient information. So that one shook me up. Look, I was working under security. I've been lecturing for, at that time, I hadn't given any lectures in 1960. But when you work under security, sometimes you are rather careful in what you say to avoid releasing classified information. There are certain rules, and you try not to lie, but you don't want to give out classified data either. But flat-out lying was something new to me, especially from the Secretary of the Air Force. So I was determined to get to the bottom of this. I joined APRO and NICAP. We talked about it, brown bagging lunches at the technical places that I work. And I gave my first lecture. It's hard to imagine looking back at my life, you know, what a strange way to start my public UFO career. Frank Edwards had published a book, Flying Saucer Serious Business, in the mid-60s. I was living in Indianapolis. I spent 3 years at each of several places as they canceled government-sponsored research and development programs. You know, see the country, work on radiation shielding for nuclear systems. You'll get a chance to change jobs every so often. Anyway, I'd gotten to know Frank in Indianapolis, and he sent me a copy of his new book. And I called him, and I said, Frank, you know everybody. He was a newsman, radio program, and he was active in NICAP and so on the board. I said, Frank, you know everybody. Here I am in Pittsburgh, work for Westinghouse. Give me some names. I'd like to speak out publicly. So he gave me a bunch of names. One of them was a producer of a talk show at KDKA Pittsburgh, one of the old-time radio stations, right. One of the biggest...
famous station.
Clear Channel station. And so I called them. The guy was a producer of a show called, would you believe, Contact. I love the title in retrospect. And I gave him the pitch, you know, I'm a Westinghouse nuclear physicist. Normally that would mean something, but his was kind of, don't call us, we'll call you. Less than a month later, he called me at 6:30. Could I be on the show at 7 o'clock? I live near the station. It turns out somebody had canceled at the last minute, and I've often wondered, how many people did they call who couldn't make it before they finally got down to the bottom of the list, you know, call Friedman. So I did the show. And I wasn't as good then as I am now at handling nasty, noisy negative, as the show host didn't know what he was talking about, but I was too polite, frankly. But a woman at work, a technical assistant, was involved with a book review club, and the book they were reviewing was Frank's book. She asked me to give a talk to her club in her living room. That was my first lecture. I was on that show many times after that, did a whole bunch more lectures. Mostly the chicken and peas circuit, as I like to call it. You know, everybody needs a free program, and we'll give you dinner. sometimes you get gas, you know. And then another serendipitous event. I lived downtown Pittsburgh. Westinghouse, where I worked, was out of town. And one of 2 days, we'd take turns. People who had to leave their car in a garage, you know, and they'd drive the other, pick them up and drop them off later. Going into work with Joanne, PhD, supervisor at Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab. And I'm telling her, you know, I'd really like to speak at Carnegie Mellon University. She says, why don't you talk to the dean? I said, well, I talked to Dr. So-and-so, and he wasn't interested. She said, Stan, the dean's my husband. He's heard you on the radio. Give him a call. Okay. So I did, and he booked me. We set up a date, but it was a daytime talk, and I knew I'd have to take some time off work. So he finally asked, how much do you want? And I thought, well, how about $100, thinking he'd knock me down to $50. This is back in the 60s, you understand. Sold, and then because I knew his wife, he told me what he was paying the other speakers in this series. 1,500, 1,600, 1,800. Well, the talk went very well. He sent a letter to the agency. They booked me at a key talk for me, Engineering Society of Detroit. This is not a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes, mm-hmm. hard-nosed engineers. Turns out they were sold out 3 weeks in advance for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk. And there wasn't one negative attack of any kind.
Now, what year was this?
This would have been, 68, maybe.
Okay.
And so, funny thing, I asked management. I said, look, I'd like to do more lectures, but I've got a security clearance. I've got a wife. I've got a house. I've got a kid, mortgage. I don't want to lose any of these things. I need some guidance. What can I do and what can I do? I don't want somebody to come to me, well, we don't like what you've been doing, so you're fired kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
You're casting a bad light on the company or something like that. So my boss's boss's boss, somebody comes back with the guidance. Three things, Stan. You can say what you please on your time. You can identify yourself as a Westinghouse nuclear physicist. But we would like you to start each lecture with a disclaimer. The views you're about to hear are mine and mine alone and not those of my employer. What more could you ask for? Well, something more. I get a call from an associate at Los Alamos, also working on nuclear rockets. Hey, Stan, how about speaking to the local chapter of the American Nuclear Society? I said, I'd love to. Well, I mean on an expense account, Stan. I don't make those decisions. I'm in Pittsburgh. He's in New Mexico, you know. Mm-hmm. So I talked to management, and they said yes. I mean, Westinghouse is a corporate member of the American Nuclear Society. I'm a member of the American Nuclear Society. But still, they didn't have to say yes. So I went out there with everybody knowing I was there to give a lecture, Flying Saucers Are Real, to the Los Alamos section of the American Nuclear Society. We had 500 people there. For them, a very big crowd. No negative reactions at all. So when it came time to get off the business of working 3 years, 3 years, 3 years, you know, they weren't spending money anymore and stuff that I was interested in. I finally went full-time in 1970. Never really turned back. I've done some technical work along the way, but but what I found, several things. I'm not a masochist. I found that the response was extremely good, and I come on very, very strong. I'm not an apologist ufologist. I found that not only are people interested, but they're attentive, they're curious, but they're fearful of ridicule. As strong as I come on, I've only had 11 hecklers in over 700 lectures, and two of them were drunk. So, you know, you're going to get that many if you talk about sports, religion, politics, whatever.
I'd like to have that record. I used to do stand-up comedy. I would love.
Oh, boy. Somebody asked me the other night, I don't know whether he was kidding or not, Stan, this was in Exeter, have you given any thought to doing stand-up comedy? And I don't know whether that was a compliment or not, But
well, you're an entertaining guy, so let's say it was a compliment.
I do bring to the subject several things. One of them is I worked on far-out propulsion systems, which gets to the heart of the question, can you get here from there or not? Mm-hmm. Second, I worked under security, so I know about keeping secrets and stuff. Third, as it turns out, for most of my life, I've had a very good memory, so I could give you an answer now. I don't say I'll get back to you tomorrow. This isn't a question and answer period. Fourth, people are willing to accept data, but what they really want to know is why. Why would aliens come here? Why doesn't the government tell us what it knows? Why don't they land on the White House lawn, stuff like that? And the usual response when I give my answers is, oh, I hadn't thought of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense. So I'm playing to my strength. Now, there was a very important moment in my childhood. Fifth grade, Rose Gutkin was teaching us about science. And the sun stands still, and the planets move around the sun. Well, I just read, we were buying the encyclopedia one volume at a time from the supermarket. I think it was 49 cents a volume or something. This is a very long time ago. And I said, no, Miss Gutkin. Now, I didn't sass teachers. I was an A student. I said, no, the whole solar system's moving around the galaxy at 12 miles a second, which seemed horribly fast to me, you know. No, that isn't right. She gave me a hard time. And I wasn't accustomed to somebody coming down hard. I mean, not a teacher. So the next day I brought in the volume of the encyclopedia. And she very reluctantly admitted, well, maybe that was right. But it taught me a lesson. If you're going to take on authority figures, have facts in hand before putting mouth in gear, or they'll chop your head off, you know. So I've tried to stick by that. And other people who want to speak out, I say, look, there are a couple of basic rules. Do your homework first. Never lie to an audience.
Okay.
You may get away with it for a while, but I don't think it's good policy. Stick to the fact. And don't be afraid to say, I don't know. Basic rules. So I have enjoyed being a performer, a stand-up, if you will. I've enjoyed doing radio and television. You know, there are times when you get upset about, well, it did Ted Koppel's Nightline. It was the, 40th anniversary of Kenneth Arnold's sighting. I was in Washington for a MUFON conference, and they had Phil Klass and I on. And we're going to be talking about government cover-up. Now, the show was a little shorter than it had to be because Jackie Gleason had died that day, so they had to spend a few minutes on him. But when we went in there, I've got a bunch of blacked-out documents. We're talking about government cover-up. See, here's the proof. Oh, you can't bring anything in. Why not? Well, that's not how we do things here. And you argue a little bit and you lose, you know. And then the circumstances. They put me facing a camera and Phil 2 feet away from me facing a camera. Don't look at each other. Now, how can you argue with somebody and not look at them? You know, it might as well be by radio, by phone, you know. And so we went at it. And people next day at the MUFON conference asked me, how did it go? I said, I don't know. You're on the show. I said, look, I don't know what you saw. I don't know what the audience saw. We each have a camera. Well, how was Ted? Well, I don't know. I never saw him. Well, did you see him on a monitor? No. I heard him through my ear. Now, you denied all the nonverbal cues that you and I sitting here, I can see when you raise an eyebrow, you know,
right,
and stuff
right.
like that. It's a strange way to do stuff. And then you get the dishonest people. I get a call from a guy in California. Southern California. They're doing a show on abductions and for Dick Clark. Now, if you can't trust Dick Clark, who can you trust, you know? And they'd done most of the show, but they needed to sharpen it up a little bit. Could I come out? And they'd ask me questions. And, okay, I have a daughter in Southern California. I don't often get a chance to see her, so this would be a chance to see my daughter. Okay. And they asked me a whole bunch of questions. I gave them answers. They must have liked them because they used a lot of them on the show. What the show basically was, they had this cockamamie story that this family in Minnesota had encounters with aliens and had filmed it, and the film was found later. How exciting, you know. And they would have my comments. They'd ask about electromagnetic effects, and I would talk about them. Then they'd show something happening in the story. And I was used and abused, but good. And people came down on me. Oh, Stan, how could you get involved with that? And I said, well, you know, that's not the story I was told. Nobody asked me about that footage, but they cleverly intercut what I said with what was there. And
we'll try not to do that. We're talking with Stanton T. Friedman, and we'll try to be honest here in our approach.
I trust you, Jerry.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back and wrap this up. I've got a big question for you, and that is basically, why did Jesse Marcel finally come clean, start talking about all this? We'll be right back. I'm Jerry Pippen.
Here is a great getaway idea. Attend the 2011 Paranormal Symposium that's being held this year at the Kachina Lodge in historic, mysterious, and beautiful Taos, New Mexico. The event has a little something for everyone and will be held from October 25 through October 30th. Go to the 2011 Paranormal Symposium website. We have links to it on our websites on the program pages at jerrypippen.com. Or just Google it. This is not just a UFO or paranormal conference, even though there are several major speakers in those fields scheduled. There are many other events, including, for instance, on Saturday night, October 29th, Paul Davids, the well-known Hollywood producer and writer, is screening his new film, The Life After Death Project. It's just one of the many free events planned for this year's Paranormal Symposium and Film Festival. Make your reservations now at aspiefiles.org.
anybody here have a question for Stanton Freeman? You want to ask him?
Yes,
okay. Okay, let me get over there, and we'll do about 10 minutes.
Okay, yeah. What was Ted Koppel like? I think he was in Timbuktu. No. Oh, no. It was about a family in Minnesota, the abduction of the McGriffin family or something like that. And, you know, they showed nice green grass in Minnesota in the winter. You're not going to find it.
And that's Stanton T. Freeman going a little bit further about what Dick Clark Productions did to him. Another thing, Stanton, they did to you I thought was highly unfair was the Peter Jennings special.
Oh, boy.
And it appeared to me that there was two different specials going on there. The first part of that program looked pretty straightforward, and then somebody came in and talked to somebody or something.
Well, you know, that was a terrible experience, really.
It had to be.
Another one. I call it the Peter Jennings mockumentary. I mean, okay, I'm in Roswell. They want to talk to me. We go down to the art museum there. Nice art museum, good setting. Guy asked me questions for over an hour. Good questions. This was a sensible, straightforward kind of discussion. I knew I was in trouble, though, when after we'd wrapped up, he said, Stan, don't you think if these things were real that half the academics and scientists would be working on UFOs? I said, absolutely not. Those who can do, those who can't teach. You know, and we talked about this earlier, that of course they wouldn't be going to academics. But we did over an hour interview. Turns out they interviewed 150 people. Only 50 of us made the cut. That included John Mack didn't make the cut. A whole bunch of PhDs. And I'll give you why I think they did this. But I got 20 seconds. They called me, and what was that word? An operator. Twice. They said the witnesses just came out of the woodwork. You know, there was nothing to it. And I was really angry because one was a personal reason. I had thought I'd do better with Peter Jennings. I liked his work. I'd seen a program he did on the Catholic Church in old days, and I thought he did a fine job on it. Also, we're both born on July 29th, and we were both dual citizens of the United States and Canada. So I thought I ought to get a fair shake out of him, you know, if nothing else. I'd forgotten, I checked later, Benito Mussolini was also born on July 29th. But here's the kicker on this show. They had a lot of money. They spent a lot of money. They came to the MUFON conference. John Shusho set them up with a whole bunch of people. They didn't use any of it. They used Peter Davenport as if he was the only investigator in the country working on UFO stuff. Why do you interview 150 people for a two-hour show minus commercials? You know, that's not a lot of time. And so I have a conspiracy theory. Somebody said, how are we going to find out what these idiots in ufology know? Do they know anything useful? Are they going to expose us? Well, I know one way you could do it, says one of the guys. Give him a chance to be on a documentary with one of the big three news guys, you know, ABC, NBC, CBS. They all like to see their face on the tube. And so they arrange all these interviews. Like I say, 150. And, you know, as part of that, they asked me if I had any footage from television with me in it. I think I got loads of hunks of film, but I don't have time to go through that. Well, send it to us. We'll do it. I sent him 56 or 7 VHS tapes. They did send them back. What the hell did they do with all that stuff? There was some good stuff about Roswell on there, I'll tell you that. And so I thought it was disgraceful, that it really was. They attacked Roswell. They attacked abductions. They cut out most of what Bud Hopkins had said. They had Susan Clancy saying stupid things about why people think they were abducted, sleep paralysis and stuff like that. You know, Betty and Barney Hill were obviously sleeping when they were driving in New Hampshire, you know. What was the purpose of the show? You're right, the first part was very good, and the rest was, there was garbage. They should have, I was glad about one thing. It was only seen by 14 million people. The Unsolved Mysteries program that I had instigated back in 89 was seen by 28 million people the first time around and 30 million the second time. So there, Peter, take that.
Yeah, take it. I think your theory, your hypothesis about what they were doing is probably correct. And who at ABC knew about it and who didn't, that's another question.
That is another question. And, you know, people forget, in all honesty, there have been times in the past when the media have been asked to cooperate. The word uranium was forbidden to be used during World War II. We could not talk about Fugol balloons. They didn't want the Japanese to know whether they'd done any damage or not. And it's the kind of article that would have been picked up, you know, balloon explodes, family heard, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not that the media hasn't gone along. The New York Times knew about the Cuban Missile business. And Jack Kennedy once said he wished they had published it, because you know, then it would have stopped, yeah. You know. So, you know, it's not a conspiracy. There's no question the government's been lying, misrepresenting, and, you know, in short, not being honest with its citizens. Now, you asked me about Jesse Marcel.
Yeah, I was going to get to that.
Okay, get to it.
Yeah, okay, it basically is, why did he talk to you?
Well, you know, I've had a lot of people say, why did all those guys, and it's not just Jesse, a bunch of other witnesses, come running to you, Friedman? Well, and the answer is they didn't. Jesse didn't come to me.
I know you seeked him out, and well, you worked at it.
Here's the kicker. I'm at a television station doing a promotion, three interviews, supposedly, concerning my lecture that night at Louisiana State University. And I'd done two, and the third reporter was nowhere to be found. This is before cell phones. So the station manager, who's arranged all this stuff, he knew the person who brought me to the station. He's apologetic. He's giving me coffee. He's looking at his watch. You know, where the heck is this darn reporter? And out of the blue, because he knows I have other things to do and I can't stay here forever, you know, out of the blue he says, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. And me, being the brilliant investigator I am, I said, who's he? And his answer floored me. Well, he handled wreckage of one of those saucers you were interested in when he was in the military. What? Where'd that come from? You know, totally out of the blue, literally. I said, well, what do you know about him? Where is he? Is he alive? Yeah, he lives down in Houma. I'll admit, I didn't know where Houma, Louisiana was. I've been there since, and it's a pretty good-sized town. He's a great guy. We're old ham radio buddies. Give him a call. And then the reporter showed up, the one who had been late. So I did her interview, did the program that night, and things went extremely well. We had a great crowd, very friendly crowd. So the next day from the airport, I was there a little early. I thought, you know, I ought to give that a try. So I call information in Houma. This is before the internet, you know, you didn't go quickly. There was a listing for a Jesse Marcel, and I called him. And I used the name Bill Allen of the television guy, station guy. And so Jesse's one of the few people that couldn't deny he was involved. His name shows up in papers all over the place, even in China and in England and so forth. His picture's in a lot of papers, too. So he told me a story. He couldn't deny it, and he wasn't going to be a liar about, oh, I don't know anything about that, you know. And I came with a good reference, Alan. So he told me a story. He didn't know the exact date, though. I mean, he's the intelligence officer of the 509th in Roswell. So it's the kind of thing you sort of file. What am I going to do now? Well, what I did was, a few months later, I'm in Bemidji, Minnesota, and somebody comes up to me after the lecture. You ever hear anything about a crash saucer in New Mexico? Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I have. I didn't tell him what I had heard, but so he tells me his story, and that relates, as it turns out, to the Plains of San Augustine case about the guy who was the engineer, Barney Barnett. His first name isn't Barney, but Barney Barnett. And he had, the person who was talking to me, had Barney's niece, his wife's niece's number and address. So I took that information. I shared them with Bill Moore the next day, who lived in Minnesota. Bill had a third story. It was beginning to get interesting. There was an article in the Flying Saucer Review, an English publication, and talks about an English actor driving across the country in the United States, hearing on the radio about a crashed saucer in New Mexico, and thinking there'd be a big fuss when he got back to Philadelphia, and there was nothing. So that guy, his son lived in Canada, I guess, and Bill talked to him. Anyway, he got a date. It wasn't a trip you made very often. You can imagine what the roads were like back in 1947. You know, no highway system. It was a mess. Almost as bad as part of the road up here to Angel Fire. You know? And so I've talked to that actor. He's dead now, Huey Green. Anyway, he could pin down the date because it wasn't a trip he made often, early July 47. So Bill went to the University of Minnesota Library, periodicals department, started looking in July 47, and there's the story. With Jesse Marcel's name, of course, and giving us a bunch of other names. Walter Hout, spelled four different ways, I might add. And Blanchard and, you know, the whole crew. So from that point on, we spent about a year and a half tracking down 62 people. And in almost all cases, it was you call Joe and you remember anybody else who was there. If you get him talking for 5 or 10 minutes, at first he'll say, oh, no, it was a long time ago. I don't remember anybody. You get him back into that time frame of reference. Hey, have you talked to Bill Smith or John Johnson or whatever? And a lot of the wives had Christmas lists, Christmas card lists. The military guys tended to stick together a bit. So we tracked down 62 people. That led to the first book, The Roswell Incident, by Berlitz and Charles Berlitz and William Moore. I got a percentage of the royalties, so they acknowledged my contribution, if you will. And Bill and I kept at it. By 1986, we'd found 92 people. And then I instigated the Unsolved Mysteries program, seen by 28 million people. And believe it or not, it was very strange. They didn't give out their toll-free number during the Roswell segment on that for some reason. There are two other short segments, a half hour in Roswell and two other short segments. They gave it out for if anybody knows where somebody is, you know. And they got dozens of calls from people about Roswell. People heard about it from a neighbor, a cousin, somebody else had talked to him about it. So that led to Don Berliner and my book and so forth. But in no case were people running to us. And, well, sometimes you get lucky. But luck is what happens when you're ready for it. I check editor and publisher. There's a newspaper in Roswell. I didn't know that. Okay. I didn't know anything about Roswell. The Roswell Daily Record. So I call the record and explain, I'm looking for the editor from 1947. Long gone, what do you need? Well, I tell her, I've got this article. It talks about the base public information officer. I didn't even know the base had been closed for years already. A guy named Walter Hout, his name is spelled four different ways. And before I could finish the sentence, his wife works here. What? You don't expect a GI who was there in 47 to still be there, you know, in 80. At 79, and I talked to his wife, and I talked to Walter. He had a base yearbook. So you can say I was lucky. Another time, I want to find anybody named Brazel. And again, I call information, no internet. And, you know, only one area code for New Mexico at that time, of course. And you were always talking to somebody who was in the area code, not like today where they're off some next to some computer somewhere. And so you can ask questions like, is that a nice part of town, or things like that. I want to find anybody named Brazel. What city? I don't know, but southeastern New Mexico, I'd say. Well, I've got a William in Carrizozo. I said, is that in southeastern New Mexico? Well, I didn't know. Yes, it is. It turns out that was the son of the rancher. And I pass it on to Bill, and he called him. And so he had tried that like 2 weeks earlier, and Brazel had just gotten his phone. That we lucked out, you could say.
Yeah, it's according to who you get as the operator. Very lucky sometimes. Some of these information operators, others overlook it.
Well,
we've tried that technique a lot.
Back then, you know, people who worked for the phone company then were different than now. They didn't have much competition, and they took themselves seriously. And I've had good luck back then. Sometimes today with the www.411.com, they can drive you up the wall.
Basically, Jesse Marcel talked to you and told you the truth, but he was reluctant. Would you say that?
Well, he certainly hadn't come running to me.
Okay.
And I talked to him later on, and then because I was working on a movie, UFOs Are Real, he was one of the people we wanted to interview. So we visited him in Houma, Louisiana. I filmed him sitting right at his ham radio rig.
Hopefully the same thing will happen with this Magic Man movie.
Well, Magic Man, and what I'm hoping... Look, let me give you another example of what I'm hoping for. I figured out that, maybe Thomas Jefferson Dubose is alive, and maybe he's shown in the picture with General Ramey, with those pieces of junk on Ramey's floor, you know. I figured if he was a colonel at that time, he was probably a West Pointer, because they stayed in after the war. They didn't get out. So I called West Point, and yes, he was alive. And they didn't tell me exactly where he was, but it was in the South. Eventually, I found him, and I called him, and then I visited him. My folks were retired in Florida. He lived in Florida. So I met with him twice, and he said something in our last conversation. He liked the work I'm doing. If I remember anything more, I'll let you know. What can they do to me now? He was 87. So the kind of thing you're hoping for something like Magic Man.
Understand.
Is somebody who will say, what can they do to me now? I typed a document, or I filed reports, or whatever. And the thing is that I found people are decent. For example, I would get people, find their picture in the yearbook, I'd send them a copy of the picture. That whole page would have people that they worked with, you know. They were grateful. And I swore I wouldn't use their name without permission and stuff like that. And I don't. So you have to respect people is what I'm saying, especially older people. I mean, I can say that now that I'm older, but, you know.
Dennis Balthaser, I always get his name wrong. Dennis Balthaser.
That's right.
Did I get close?
Close enough.
Okay, good. You have known Stanton a long time, and you're here in the audience. You're here with your own job. You're emceeing this time.
I am, and I'm finding it's a lot harder than just doing a lecture.
Yeah, you told me some time back that you were still working on it.
I am. I had to do all the bios, get the bios, and work up the introductions, and I'm looking forward to it because we got some good speakers this year, and it's a new experience for me. I worked with Stanton off and on for the last 12, 13 years, and I can relate to what he's talking about with the media problems because him and I both had a situation with the National Geographic a couple of years ago where we spent hours taping with them, and the last thing the announcer said was that Roswell was a myth. So you never know what the editor's going to
do. He obviously had seen Peter Jennings' show.
I guess. I don't know. But
this program will be broadcast on Friday. Stanton, your speech is what time?
Friday at 7 o'clock.
So you have plenty of time to get down here. If you're in northern New Mexico, a scenic drive, to say the least, disregard what Stanton said about the highways. They're not bad.
No. And southern Colorado, too. We look for people to come down from up in Colorado. We'll probably have some come up from Texas and over from Arizona. So we're looking for a good symposium.
And you have a question for Stanton?
No, just keep doing what you're doing.
Well, Stanton's an old media guy. He knows we got to sneak in a plug some way, Stanton. We just did it.
Well, yeah. and let me give my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. You get all my books with autographs, mind you, which you don't get from Amazon.com. No charge for the autograph. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Anyone else have a question for Stanton? We have but several people in the audience. Anybody have a question at all? Okay. They're all bashful. They don't.
I like my roast beef rare.
Stanton, it's always a pleasure having you on. Anything that we haven't covered we need to do?
No. I think what is important right now is to realize how important for people on this planet to begin thinking of themselves as earthlings instead of all those nationalistic labels. Nationalism has got us in one heck of a lot of trouble. That's what the wars are about. I've got a great-grandson. I'd like him to grow up in a more peaceful world than I've been fortunate enough to grow up in. And I think a big part of that is recognizing we're part of a galactic neighborhood, not just one country or one continent. And I'm hopeful. I'm an optimist still.
Thanks very much. And one final question about Magic 12. Something like that still exists, I'm sure.
Well, I'm sure the name has been changed. When classified names get out, you
probably
change the name.
Probably it's Magic 36 now or something.
Yeah, the whole point is you need an organization like that to be at the hub of that Western wagon wheel without a rim. The spokes bring information in, but not around. You need some place that has to coordinate the technical data you get from wreckage, the observational data you get from airplanes chasing UFOs, radar information, all that sort of stuff. Somebody to put it all together. I'm sure that group still exists. I wish they'd give me a call.
And you can find him on WWW White Pages, probably. Well, just go to your website, StanFriedman.com.
StantonFriedman.com.
Thanks very much, Stan. It's always a pleasure.